Production funding for Behind the Headlines is made possible in part by the WKNO Production Fund, the WKNO Endowment Fund, and by viewers like you. Thank you.
Memphis 3.0, the legacy of redlining and much more tonight on Behind the Headlines. I'm Eric Barnes, president and executive editor of the Daily Memphian. Thanks for joining us. I'm joined this week by a roundtable of journalists, starting with Ryan Poe, columnist with the Commercial Appeal. Thanks for being here again.
Thank you for having me.
Madeline Faber, editor of High Ground News. Thanks for being here again.
Thanks.
And Bill Dries is a reporter with the Daily Memphian. So let's start with, we're going to talk through a bunch of interrelated things that are going on right now, including a really great series that High Ground is doing on redlining right now and a map of redlining that we'll look at in a minute. Memphis 3.0 has hit some small, I would think most people would say small hiccups, and then also EDGE and the tax incentives are expanding, and in some ways, thematically, they're all related. But let's start, Bill, with where are we with Memphis 3.0? We had John Zina and a number of other people involved with it just a couple weeks ago, and it seemed like it was smooth sailing through council, but it's hit some roadblocks.
It's hit a couple of roadblocks, none of which appear to be anything like doing away with the plan. But there are some delays. A delay by the Memphis City Council on the first of three readings. This is after a group from North Memphis came to the council and said, we weren't consulted on this plan, the part of the plan that deals with North Memphis, and we want you to consider what we want to do. It's a very specific plan that a community development corporation there has put forward. And then at the same time, you had some city council members who didn't have that specific objection, but who said, how does this work with our process for approving developments that come to us? What does this add to it? Does it conflict with anything, any of the recommendations we get now from planning and development? So they decided to take time for a public meeting in North Memphis to take in the input, see if they want to change the plan or the recommendation on it, and then vote on the first of three readings.
Ryan, and we'll start with Ryan and then go to Madeline. The opposition to the plan was in part from this group from New Chicago that Bill referenced. Carnita Atwater is one of the people in charge of that. And some issues have been brought up with her. Two nonprofits she was involved in lost their status. There's a very difficult court case that she's named in a civil probate course where she has been asked to return a bunch of money. So that maybe shed some doubt on her as the leader of this opposition. I think you wrote a column in the 901, though, saying there may be some questions about her, but the issues she's raising still need to be discussed. Is that
right,
fair?
Yeah. The issues she's raising are bigger than her, and they are issues that are going to be top of mind, I think, going into the mayoral election. You have former Mayor Willie Harrington, Shelby County Commissioner Tammy Sawyer, who are running against Mayor Jim Strickland, and they have both pointed out that parts of Memphis have seemingly been left behind by the city's momentum that Mayor Strickland has brought up. And so that, I think that's really going to be one of the key focuses of the election going forward is just, you know, how does Memphis momentum, how does Memphis move forward for all of Memphians and not just certain parts of Memphis? And Mayor Strickland has said that he acknowledges that problem as well.
Yeah, I mean, he opened his campaign in Whitehaven. He's been trying to, you know, be everywhere. And 3.0, for those who don't follow as closely as we all do, is a kind of strategic plan and a guide, 600 pages. I mean, it's hundreds of pages, and it goes through the city, neighborhood by neighborhood, area by area, and says here's the roadmap for each of these areas and how it fits individually in these neighborhoods out and how it rolls together. And has, I think, seven or so anchor areas that are sort of prime areas for redevelopment, including north, south, east, and west in Memphis. Again, that's the folks who are supporters and behind it. Would say. Your thoughts on this, again, Madeline, in terms of, and it ultimately gets to redlining. I mean, it's hard not to get to that in the stories that you all have done on the history of redlining, but your thoughts on some of the questions being raised on Memphis 3.0?
Yeah, so I agree with that aspect of Ryan's take that the issues about Dr. Atwater's business dealings or personal dealings should I mean, we should write about them, but they shouldn't detract from what she's saying, which is that I don't feel like my voice was heard. I don't feel like my community has been recognized, and I don't trust this process, which is probably more widespread than we really realize. I mean, as you said, the 3.0 master document is 600 whatever pages, you know, with indexes and addendums. I mean, I didn't like to read it, and I have to do this, right? Can you imagine, you know, all the residents in Memphis, right, who were presented with this document that they're supposed to trust to shape their future, which seems a bit unapproachable. And so I think that's what a takeaway that we should examine from the North Memphis opposition is not maybe necessarily, you know, the content of Dr. Atwater's past, but the fact that they don't feel like they've been fully recognized in this process.
People I've talked to have said that they did reach out to people, and they did, and they kind of have a beef with this idea that they weren't asking for input, and that all has to be played out. I think the other part is, you know, one of the issues that Dr. Atwater raised and other people have raised, and we've talked about on the show before, is gentrification, and you know, do cities, and this is a national thing. You look at Nashville right now; I mean, it's booming, but there are a lot of people up there saying, "Wait, this is sort of pushing out people who aren't wealthy, who aren't rich." I mean, it's becoming a city for rich people. It happened in some ways in Atlanta and so New York right now. But the other thing, then she brought up genocide, and she brought up this really awful past that sort of seemed, I think, to a lot of observers outside the bounds of fair criticism. But gentrification, I think, is a concern that a lot of people have as parts of the city see all this booming development, Bill. And that's an interesting thing that does come up with in the mayor's race and so on.
It does. Gentrification and displacement. But the other issue is also who really speaks for a community. And are communities monolithic in what they want to say, and want to see done in their areas? I don't think they are. And I think in an area like North Memphis, and in particular the area around the old Firestone Tire and Rubber Company plant, which has such a history of neglect that we'll go into very soon here, that in those areas you tend to have a lot of ideas for what should happen in that particular area. In some ways, Atwater's objections were not really about her plan. They were about some of the desperation in that area and people who are looking and who are saying, why can't the Firestone site be used for something?
Right.
Why can't that in some altered way be the economic engine that it once was for this blue-collar community that whose future and fate was absolutely linked to that plant being there?
Yeah. Well, with that, and we talk about the history, let's go to, and we'll come back to some of the 3.0 issues and so on, but that you all are doing a series the second part has just gone up, on redlining and the history of redlining in Memphis. And you all got your hands on a map that showed redlining going back to the 1930s, right, coming out of the New Deal, redlining plans and this kind of the way the federal government imposed, enabled lending in some areas and not others in cities around the country is pretty profound. But you all have the map from Memphis, which we'll take a look at here. But talk about the series and what it shows.
Yeah, so this map came to us from the Digital Scholarship Lab, which is based at the University of Richmond. And what they're doing is unearthing redlining maps from the National Archives and digitizing them and overlaying them with health outcome data, poverty data, education outcomes. And you can see with this current information how these past policies have put communities at a disadvantage.
And let me walk viewers through the map real quickly. This is from around the 1930s, we think.
Yes.
And so the top, up at the very top, would be the Wolf River, obviously the Mississippi over to the left. The right, the end of the color coding to the right is Goodlet. And the bottom of the color coding is Park Avenue, and that red area that kind of sticks down, that's the Orange Mound neighborhood. And so walk people through, Madeline, what red and blue and green and very distinct differences that were planned and for these different neighborhoods.
So this was a map that was federally commissioned, used by lenders, mortgage companies, home constructors to decide which areas of town were risky for investment, which were not risky for investment. And we can see just by the way this map looks and by the way we know Memphis has grown, red means these are black neighborhoods. Blue and green are wealthier neighborhoods that saw the benefit of decades of investment, new home construction, and mortgage lending.
And we've zoomed in on the legend, which is just really, I mean, it was kind of breathtaking. you know, that the green areas were best, down to the red areas are hazardous. And then you've got two, you know, references to White Slum Clearance Project. That was a public housing project. We think that was Lauderdale. Is that right, Bill?
Lauderdale Courts.
And we think what they've referenced here is the Negro Slum Clearance Project. I apologize for saying that, but I wanted to read it.
Dixie Homes.
Right. Back to you. Yeah, Mamel.
And so what we're interested in looking at in High Ground News is how these policies have handicapped Memphis in a lot of ways, handicapped Black Memphians in a lot of ways, and why this kind of promise of home ownership, right, as a means to obtain wealth, kind of is a loaded sort of question to propose to our historically Black communities.
Yeah, those are areas that you talk about, and it's in the story. I mean, those are areas in the red there that were hit incredibly hard in the foreclosure crisis. And
right,
the foreclosure,
exactly.
Foreclosures hit everyone in the country, but disproportionately hit poor people and certainly people of color.
I mean, more than 60% of mortgages in a particular South Memphis zip code are underwater. It was one of the hardest hit in the complete, yeah. in the country, right?
Yeah.
And we can see that, the history of that, from these communities being denied lending, being denied the opportunity to build collateral and capital, prevent them from getting fair mortgages.
Right. Right.
And this is 80 years after, we're talking about events 80 years after this map
yeah,
was drawn.
Right. Right.
And of course, redlining stopped with the Fair Housing Act in 1968, but these practices still continue. Wells Fargo, First Tennessee Bank,
yeah.
Bancorp South, all sued in the last 7 years for discriminatory lending.
Yeah. Your thoughts when you saw the map and when you think about these issues we cover now in all our various publications and then related to an 80-year-old map?
Yeah, it's a great series, and I'm glad High Ground News is doing that. But what it really shows, I think, is kind of takes it from, like Madeline said, from what kind of happened in the past in history to what we see now. And what we see now is a lot of those subprime mortgages, all those that in the housing crisis when you know, people went underwater. What happened to those homes is they were sold to rental owners.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And what we have now is almost an epidemic in Memphis of blighted rental properties with outside owners who don't take care of them. And that's just contributing to the blight in the neighborhoods, some of the cleanliness issues that we see on Memphis streets. There's just a lot of issues that affect all Memphians that just have kind of arisen out of that.
Yeah.
So it's... Yeah,
we had Steve Barlow and folks from Neighborhood Preservation Inc. on, and I think you referenced them earlier. And I think it's now that something like 25% of the home sales in residential home sales in Memphis are, or 25% of the homes in Memphis are rental now. Many of those out of town. Many of those big hedge funds and public investment companies, or just individuals, maybe locally or in California or wherever, who own all these. You were going to say something.
I was going to say the number that we have is actually higher. It's 33% of all homes in Memphis are now rentals, and a lot of this work with the Mapping Inequality Project is coming. Inspired by Neighborhood Preservation Inc., which is doing great work on the ground to sort of turn this around, especially through a new kind of way to approach mortgage lending called the Opportunity Loan Fund, which we write about in our second part of this series.
At High Ground News. The map came, just to be clear, the map came from where, what's the name and the groups behind it?
So it's the Digital Scholarship Lab, which is housed at the University of Richmond and a few other academic institutions. They've put 150 of these redlining maps online already, digitizing them from the colored pencil version that you saw above, and turning them into something that one can click on and manipulate with the data. Memphis is not yet digitized, but it should be up in May.
Okay. And when it's digitized, you'll be able to hover over areas and click and see up-to-date data on what's happening in those areas, the population, things like that?
That's going to be some of the data that Neighborhood Preservation Inc. is adding. So they're going to add our local data on top of this to create a full picture.
All this kind of segues into, you know, conversations about tax incentives and growth and where growth happens in Memphis. So, we're talking about 3.0 and its, you know, attempt to sort of identify across the city areas of investment, areas of growth, linking it all together. But there's always this debate, Bill, about tax incentives and pilots and so on and so forth. Just this past week, the County Commission approved some money for EDGE, which administers pilots and other tax incentives, which we'll talk about the kind of hodgepodge and the reworking of that hodgepodge of entities that work on this stuff. But what are those two positions? I think they were funding two positions. The city's about to vote, city council's about to vote on whether it's going to also put up, $300,000 over 3 years. Mm-hmm. Talk about the expansion of EDGE.
It's basically a follow-through on the discussions we've been having for about the last year about whether our economic development strategy works and who it works for. So as part of that, EDGE becomes more aggressive in this. And becomes more detailed in its approach and more responsive to what leaders need to know in terms of granting these incentives. And so to do that, you have more staff, and that's what the funding is essentially for. And an interesting discussion on the Shelby County Commission side that you will probably see happen on the city side as well, and that is, how do we know this is going to work? How do we know this is going to give us a better quality product in terms of evaluating where we spend this money?
There are right now, there's so many tax incentive projects going on of various types, whether they're pilot, they're TDZ, they're TIF. I mean, everything from the convention center hotels, which is a lot of money potentially going there. There are apartment projects all over, certainly in the middle of Memphis, downtown. But one of the ones that got some attention nationally, Ryan, and you wrote about this in the 901, was a Wall Street Journal article that highlighted, had a kind of, kind of an absurd take on the real debate between the city and Graceland over incentives for Graceland and the expansion in Graceland. They've added the big hotel, they've added a lot of convention and exhibit space, and they're talking about now adding a manufacturing center. They, of course, want to add some kind of music venue, and that gets into the whole Grizzlies thing. But this Wall Street Journal article, which I think if anyone does go and read it based on my bringing it up, I feel bad. But read it with a grain of salt. Yep. Your take on this article, which one said that Graceland had threatened to move Graceland to Abu Dhabi or to Nashville, just to move it, that also said, that then made these comparisons between Memphis and Nashville, which never goes well in Memphis. But this one was really absurd and just wildly inaccurate. It talked about the economic growth differences. That's real. That's data. And they are growing faster. But kind of implied that Memphis is giving away tax money, giving away incentives in the hundreds of million dollars, and meanwhile Nashville is not, which is not accurate. But go ahead, your take on that article.
Well, and you've got to remember Memphis is at this weird little place in the corner of the state with Arkansas. They just stole 60 jobs, Coca-Cola Consolidated just moved 60 jobs to Arkansas. Olive Branch, Mississippi, they've been siphoning away jobs. So it's
with massive tax incentives.
Yeah, Nashville doesn't have any of that, and it is going to take a lot of incentives to keep people from moving to those areas. But to go back to the Wall Street Journal article, I mean, it was absurd, but not so much because of the Wall Street Journal necessarily. They interviewed Joel Weinschenker, who was the Graceland director.
CEO,
head partner of Graceland Holdings.
Right. There we go, yes. Thank you, Bill.
And he was the one who said that. He said that they have gotten offers from other places. Just recently in some British newspapers, he said they've gotten an offer 10 days ago from Japan, who wanted to move everything over to Japan, all of Graceland. And it's an absurd idea, partly because Elvis, the Memphis Flyer pointed out, Elvis is buried there. So are his parents.
Right.
It'd be a nightmare.
Well, Bill, you pointed out, we're talking before
that.
The show, they don't own Graceland. They don't own the house. They own everything around it. They own maybe rights to the names and so on. But they actually, I mean, even if there was the money and interest and desire and need to brick by brick move the Graceland home, that's not up to Joel Weinschenker and company.
No, Elvis Presley's ex-wife, Priscilla Presley, and his only child, Lisa Marie Presley, own the house and all of the contents in it.
Yeah. I'm going to go back to the Nashville thing because it just drives me nuts. And I spent 90 seconds, Googling Nashville tax incentives. They got $100 million. And I'm not saying this is good or bad. I'm just saying the reality, because people talk about how, well, only Memphis does this. This is not just Memphis. If you look at the debate that cities had about recruiting Amazon, you look at New York ultimately backing off all the incentives. to some degree, virtually every city in this country is doing incentives, is in the incentives game, and they are all at war with one another, and the companies are playing them off. The Amazon was a particularly big one, but let me just go through a couple that I found in 90 seconds. $100 million to Amazon, $15 million from the city, the rest is from the state. They had tax abatements for Philips, $70 million for healthcare, HCA, the healthcare company, $44 million to Bridgestone. I didn't realize this, but in Metro Nashville government, they've got a $25 to $35 million shortfall in their budget. In part, some council members would say up there, because of all the incentives they've given out. Your companions at the Tennessean up there did a series of stories on their economic development entity, who's given out hundreds of millions of dollars, mostly as TIF loans. But they had to divert $31 million of property tax revenue to help pay off loans to developers, according to Metro Finance. And there was some $8 or $9 million last year that was diverted from school funding because of those loans. Now, many people in Memphis would love to have the growth Nashville has had. I'm not sort of picking on incentives as being bad. I just find it maddening when people sort of paint, particularly a paper as good as the Wall Street Journal normally is, that we're the only people in this, you know, having to do tax incentives. It's simply not true. You were going to say something else.
I was just going to say Graceland is the perfect example of what is wrong with economic development incentives, in my opinion. Graceland is not going anywhere, right? Obviously, they're not going anywhere. What they're doing is they're trying to drive up the amount of incentives that they get. And that's exactly what you're talking about, why Nashville has all of those incentives, why we have incentives on the books that are really unnecessary. And that's, we've had a big discussion recently about changing edge. Like Bill mentioned, that's where that's coming from. Just people are tired of giving away the farm, basically. Right.
And again, New York City is probably the best example, where Google is putting up something like $1 billion worth of investment and all these people in with minimal or no incentives. And then Amazon came in, got all these incentives, and ultimately under so much pressure backed out. With just a few minutes left, you want to try to tie this back? We've talked before on here about Memphis's growth and where investment is happening and where it isn't happening. And how does this whole conversation tie into that?
I mean, I'd love to see more projects like the ICE loan that Edge does, things that uplift the small business community in neighborhoods, especially neighborhoods where major employers have left, like Firestone. I think that small businesses that employ residents are an economic strategy for Memphis's smaller neighborhoods.
And the mayor's office and others would probably point to Binghamton, where they've gotten a grocery store there. They've gotten some development going through tax incentives in a really...
Yeah, that went very well.
Yeah, and then in South Memphis and the works has evolved with... I mean, there are some interesting neighborhood level things that are going on the incentive. But everybody involved says, look, you're not going to get... Maybe you're not going to lose Graceland if you don't do incentives, but you're certainly not going to get developers to come into Binghamton right now unless you develop some kind of incentives in place.
I mean, I think the competition is real, but I also think that businesses who are on the move and looking to do projects and trying to figure out where to go and working with site consultants, I do think, and this comes from talking to them, their philosophy is not necessarily we've got to have it to do this. Sometimes their philosophy on this is, well, everybody else is asking for these, so we feel like we should ask for it too.
Yeah. And there's another part of it too that, I mean, I have a good friend who's a commercial real estate developer who says, look, yeah, all these incentives and it's great and all that, but it's all about workforce. We don't have the workforce. I mean, we've talked about this stuff so many times on the show, and it's a broader, there are many parts to this. It's not just the tax incentive that makes these things possible. With just a couple of minutes left, let's talk real quickly. U of M has some funding for water research, aquifer research. What's going on with that, Bill?
Yes, the institute at the university that is the basic source of knowledge about our groundwater, the aquifers that are the city's source of water, have $1 million a year for the next 5 years to map where breaches are in the aquifer and look at what our policy should be in general, learn more about this very valuable resource beneath the city. They'll begin this year with 5 projects. They'll expand to 11 projects next year to just learn more about it. This is a very big effort. It involves 25 graduate students, not only from the university, but other institutions across the country.
And came out of when TVA a couple years ago was drilling into the aquifer for the new power plant there, and Protect the Aquifer was formed, and the Sierra Club got involved, and there was a kind of shift of terms of people suddenly realizing, hey, you can just drill a hole into the aquifer if you're a business or you're, you know, there's no regulation, there's not enough study of it. So it came out of that whole debate. Again, just a couple of minutes left. The bikes and scooters, you wrote in the 901 a bit about that, Ryan. The city is looking at, does the city need more bike share entities in town? Does it need more other scooter companies to come in town? There's Bird now, there's Lime. Explore Bike Share is the local bike share people. Your thoughts?
Yeah, so the city announced that they were going to increase the capacity for scooters, bikes, from 1,750 to 3,000. That's going to happen in June. So I did talk to the city officials, and they said that they think that is not only doable, they think there's going to be even more in the future. I do wonder whether we're becoming too congested in certain parts of the city. But the good news is that the city's plans are to not just expand the number in those areas, midtown, downtown. They want to expand it to other parts of the city, and with payment options, thankfully, to make that more affordable, because they really are not a solution to our mass transit problems.
Yeah.
But the city does have plans to maybe contribute to that solution.
And back to Memphis 3.0, which is, besides a development plan, it's also a transportation plan. It'll be interesting to see what conversation starts happening about MATA and whether the county's going to fund them. What's next for 3.0? I'll turn to you, Bill. Is it go back to council, we assume, next week, and they're going to move forward on it, or?
Yes, they will eventually vote on this for the first of three readings.
Okay, that's where we are. Thank you all. Again, go to High Ground News and check out the stories and the map. It's fascinating and sad and really interesting stuff. Thank you all for joining us. Join us again next week.